Okay, I see that my computer says 10 a.m. on the West Coast in California, 1 o'clock on the East Coast. So let us begin. So last week I identified 15 ethical principles, distinct ethical principles, which I have in my book, and I think we got through 9 of them. I'm not going to go through all the rest of them today, but I will do 2, which I think are particularly important, and particularly important in the economic context, which is obviously what I focus on in the book, being a code of conduct for business. So the first one that I want to discuss is Hakaras HaTov. Hakaras HaTov literally means recognizing the good that someone has done for you. Now, there's a story, the paradigm for, well, for Hakaras HaTov is the story in Bereishis relating to Yosef, to Joseph's refusal to succumb to the seduction of the wife of his employer. And that illustrates, I think, the principle very well. And it also has an impact on business ethics. So we probably all know the story. Yosef refuses the entreaties of Potiphar's wife because, as the Torah says, let me share the screen. And here we go. Okay, so if you look, this is if you look at verse 9, which I have my cursor on, he wields, this is Yosef as after Potiphar's wife tries to seduce him, he says, Yosef says to himself, he wields no more authority in this house than I. This is referring to Potiphar, and he has withheld nothing from me except yourself, since you are his wife. How then could I do this most wicked thing and sin before God? So, in other words, Yosef is saying, he has given me so many benefits. He has given me all this authority, and certainly he has not allowed me to approach you, his wife. How then could I succumb to your entreaties? And do this most wicked thing. Now, the Gemara analyzes this story of Joseph's encounter with Potiphar's wife, and concludes that his refusal to succumb to these entreaties was actually it sanctified God's name. Let's look at this. And okay. Okay. Can you see the quote, the number one at the moment when Potiphar's wife? Did I share the right screen? Somebody said
Yes.
this. Yes. Okay. So this is from the Gemara Sota 36b. And it says, at that moment when Potiphar's wife grabbed his clothing, the visage of Joseph's father came and appeared in the window. His father said to him, Joseph, your brothers are destined to be inscribed upon the stones of the ephod being the breastplate that the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, wore, and you are among them. Do you want your name to be erased from among them and to be called a companion of harlots? Immediately, Joseph's bow was firmly in place. This is a reference to Bereishis 49:24. This is Jacob was giving out the blessings to his sons before he died, and the blessing reference to Joseph talks about that his bow was calm. So Rabbi Yochanan said in the name of Rameir that his bow was restored to its former state. His passion subsided. So again, he saw the image of his father, and he said, how could I do this given the chain of generations, who I am? How could I do this terrible thing knowing who I am? Now, if you go back to the story in Genesis where this encounter actually took place, you see actually something very interesting. If you go up a few verses, when Potiphar approaches him, excuse me, when the wife of Potiphar approaches him, and it says Vayimo'en, and he refused. Vayimo'en, and he refused, and he said to his master's wife, look with me here. My master gives no thoughts to anything in his house, and all that he owns he has placed in my hands. If you look at the tam, the cantillation on top of the word vayimayin, that's a shalshalas. That is the cantillation. If you, it's very noticeable if you hear the reader in the synagogue read it, because it goes vayimayin. He stretches it out a number of times. Some say three times, some say seven. Now, this cantillation only appears four times in the entire Torah. The Shalshalas only appears four times in the entire five books. And the Shalshalas, this is a word I have seen many years ago, and I don't remember where. And I've actually repeated this word every time we read this in the synagogue. The Shalshalas means chain. And when Yosef refused, he was emphasizing the chain and the link to his father and the link through the generations. And thus, this was a way of paying back his father, of recognizing the good that his father had done for him by not succumbing to Potiphar's entreaties. Now, the Sefer HaChinuch, which is a very interesting work, which catalogs all the mitzvahs, all the 613 commandments. Its author is generally unknown, although I think today we have a strong belief as to who the author is. The Sefer HaChinuch concludes that it is, and this is in mitzvah 33, that it is proper that a man recognize and bestow kindness upon one who has done a good act. And one who denies the good done by another is an evil trait held most obnoxious by God and man. So the Sefer HaChinuch talks about how this idea of recognizing the good that someone has done for you is a very important character, a very important character trait, and the opposite is a terrible character trait. Now we also see, I also in a recent work, there's also a reference to this. Story, and I think it's worth taking a look at it. So let me show this to you. Okay. So this is a quote from Aaron Levine, Economic Public Policy and Jewish Law. And again, the bolding is my bolding. It's just to emphasize the quote. It is not in the original text. So he talks about this story of Yosef, what happened with Joseph and the wife of Potiphar, and how it emphasizes the importance of Hakaras HaTov, recognizing the good that someone has done for you. So I'll just read the bolded part, but you can obviously read the entire thing. And by the way, if you want these quotes, you email me, and if you want me, I'll be happy to send these to you. So he talks about a deep sense of gratitude for his father's moral feelings, for Joseph's father's moral feelings. Hence, for Joseph, Hakaras HaTov was the link that transformed moral training into virtuous conduct. Clearly, it was Joseph's revulsion at being an ingrate which pushed the equation on him. In other words, Joseph's deep sense of gratitude to Potiphar personalized his dilemma, tearing him between lust and loyalty. I would also, do this. Submitting to God's moral code out of a sense of duty to him is fundamentally rooted in an expression of Hakaras HaTov. So there's Hakaras HaTov to God, there's Hakaras HaTov to people, but that is a very important ethical principle. Now, I also think that this comes up many times in the employment relationship. So if someone is an employee, there are mutual duties of an employer and employee. That come from the principle of Hakaras HaTov, recognizing the good. The employer provides a livelihood, and thus the employee is charged with having a duty of loyalty and due care. Those are American law concepts, by the way. Every employee owes his employer a duty of loyalty and due care. What that means, of course, is spelled out in various statutes and case law, but the principle applies. So that means that an employee must avoid conflicts of interest, must avoid disclosure of confidential information, must avoid doing business with family and friends in a way that disadvantages his employer. The employer has also duties to the employee of making sure that he's paid on time, that the working conditions are proper. I mean, I lay this out all in my book, but obviously the principle of Hakaras HaTov is an important principle in that relationship between employer and employee. The second and final ethical principle that I want to go through before we get into the issue of economic relationships in Jewish law, I covered this a bit in the first class, but this is the concept of lifnei meshuras hadin, going beyond the letter of the law. This is the concept that one should not seek to satisfy his religious obligations solely through strict compliance with the letter of the law. Rather, he's urged to go further and act more generously than the formal law requires. The source for this principle is found in Yisro's conversation, Yisro being the father-in-law of Moshe, his conversation with Moshe, where Yisro instructs Moshe to caution the people of Israel as to the decrees and teachings, and then goes further than that. So let's look it up. Let's look up the source itself so we can see it. Okay, share the screen here. Okay. And here, so Yisro says to Moshe, this is verse 20, and he's talking about Moshe teaching the Jewish people the various laws and practices, and he says, and enjoin upon them the laws and teachings, and make known to them the way they are to go and the practices they are to follow. And so we are told that the Torah discerns this principle of lifnei meshuras hadin from these words, which were uttered before the giving of the Torah, because the first chukim v'satorah, so the laws and the teaching refers to the strict laws, and then you should advise them the way that they are to go. That's beyond the letter of the law. Now, you may remember the story, what I told in the first session about Rav Chia, who was an expert in coinage, and he told a woman that a certain coin was a good coin, and it turned out not to be a good coin. And although he was an expert, that he had a basis for his opinion, he nevertheless agreed to compensate her for the value of the coin because he had issued an opinion. He had opined that it was a good coin, so that he wasn't legally required to do so, but a matter of lifnei meshuras hadin, going beyond the letter of the law, he deemed it appropriate to compensate her for the value of the coin. There is also another famous story that in the Gemara and the Talmud that is a basis for the concept of lifnei meshuras hadin. I think this is really an interesting example. This is the story of Rabba Bar Chanan and his porters. So here, Rabba Bar Chanan's porters, he was apparently a wealthy man, as you'll see in a moment, they negligently broke some barrels of wine. And Rabba Bar Chanan went to Rav, who was the leading authority of the time, and asked him to rule that the porters were responsible for breaking, they broke the vessels. They were negligent. They broke the vessels, and he asked them to compensate Rabba Bar Chanan for those vessels. And Rabba Bar Chanan refused. Excuse me, Rav refused to do so. And let's look at the source, and we will see it. No, that's the wrong source. Let me stop sharing that and go back here. Okay. Okay, so here's the story. This is Baba Metzia 83a, and here's the story with the porters of Rabba Bar Chanan. It's actually a very famous story that is another basis for lifnei meshuras hadin. So here's the story. The Gemara relates an incident involving Rabba Bar Bar Chanan, Rabba the son of the son of Chanan. Certain porters broke his barrels of wine after he had hired them to transport the barrels. He took their cloaks as payment for the lost wine. They owed him the money for being negligent in breaking the wine and breaking the vessels. They came and told Rav. Rav said to Rabba Bar Chanan, give them their cloaks. Give them back what you took. Rabba Bar Chanan said to Rav, is this the halacha? Is this what I'm supposed to do? I have to give them back their cloaks. They negligently broke my vessels and caused me the loss of the wine. Rav said to him, yes, as it is written, that you may walk in the ways of good men, quote from Proverbs. So Rabbi Bar Chanan gave them their cloaks back. The porter said to Rav, we are poor people and we toiled all day and we are hungry and we have nothing. Rav said to Rabbi Bar Chanan, go and give them their wages. In other words, not only give them back their cloaks, but pay them for what you hired them for. So Rabbi Bar Chanan said back to Rav, is this the halacha? Is this what I'm required to do by law? Rav said to him, yes, as it is written, and keep the path of the righteous. So this is one of the sources for Lefnim Mishur Sadin. There is a quote by J. David Blyth, who is a modern halachic writer who writes, who's written a multi-volume series, Contemporary Halachic Problems, and he talks about this story with Rabbi Bar Chanan, and here's what he says. I think it's interesting, and it encapsulates well what happened here. So he says as follows: there's no question that the strict letter of the law holds porters liable for damages resulting from their negligence. Having failed to perform their duties, they certainly had no claim in din, in law, for compensation. Nevertheless, Rav not only absolves them of all tort liability, but also accords them an actionable claim for their hire. The actionability of a claim, which can only be described as a claim lifnim mishuras hadin, beyond the letter of the law, is assuredly proof positive that the obligation is firmly rooted in halacha. Actionability is, after all, the litmus test of a cognizable legal obligation. So this is an opinion, it's an interesting opinion, that actually lifnim mishuras hadin, the concept of going beyond the letter of the law, is in itself required by law. This is, I would say, not the majority view, but it does explain, or it does set forth, how this idea of lifnim mishuras hadin is firmly rooted in Jewish tradition. This is also set forth in post-Talmudic commentators. So, for example, in the Mordechai is a Rishon, someone who lived before the 15th century, and he writes on this idea of Lifnim Mishuras Hadin. He writes as follows: since we see that this rule, Lifnim Mishuras Hadin, was enforced as stated at right here at the end of this chapter, this where I just read you, we too enforce the performance of an obligation that is greater than what the law strictly requires. If it is within the individual's capacity, i.e. if he is wealthy, we require him to do what the law doesn't necessarily require him to do. Now, the Bach, who is a later commentary, concludes that one is actually compelled to go lifnim mishuras hadin, that it is actually a legal requirement, like Rabbi Bach said. And I quote, it is the practice in every Jewish court to compel the wealthy to perform their obligation where it is right and proper, even if the strict law does not require. This is the Bach to the Tur in Choshen Mishpat 12:4. Anyway, we see that this concept has a long history in Jewish tradition. Now, there's a very interesting Israeli Supreme Court decision, which is based on the idea of going beyond the letter of the law. This was in a landlord-tenant case that happened in 1983, and the landlord moved to evict the tenant. And the Israeli Supreme Court, in the case of Marcus v. Hammer, and again, if you want the citation, email me and I'll send it to you. They were faced with the question of whether a certain tenant should be evicted. And obviously there were clearly mitigating circumstances. It's not as if the tenant just refused to pay the rent and the landlord moved to evict him. There were obviously mitigating circumstances. So the court actually cited to the Ramah, to a commentator on Shulchan Aruch, on the Code of Jewish Law, Choshen Mishpat 12:2. And concluded that in those circumstances, it would not be just to subject the tenant to the strict letter of the law and to evict him from the property from which he was the tenant, and that it was proper to deal with the tenant lifnim ashur sadin, beyond the letter of the law. And I quote from the case, quote, acting in this manner with regard to the eviction of a tenant under the tenant's protection law, this is an Israeli law, or at least it was in 1983, is thus part of the law in the broad sense, since it is based on an explicit statutory provision. This is similar to, this is now a commentator, Menachem Alon writing, this is similar to what we found in Jewish law. There too, in certain circumstances, acting lifnim ashuras hadin is part of what the law itself requires. So again, here you have a very modern interpretation by an Israeli court. And for those of you, I don't want to get into the politics of this situation, but obviously that's a hot topic these days. If you think the court went beyond what it was permitted to do, you might especially find interesting this decision based on the Jewish concept, and some might say halakhic concept, legal concept, of going beyond the letter of the law. So that is that's another ethical principle of lifnim ashuras hadin that, according to most authorities, goes beyond the mere minimum requirements of the law itself. Okay, now I want to switch topics and go to the issue of employment and economic activity in Jewish law and tradition. I spend a fair amount of time in my book on this subject. So the question that I want to deal with, or the issue that I want to approach, is what is the attitude of Jewish tradition? What is the attitude of the Torah, of Jewish law? What is the attitude to economic activity? Is it a positive thing? Is work and trying to earn a living and make a profit, is it a virtue? It is a positive act? Or is it something that is to be avoided and is just an economic necessity to survive, but it is not a, it's not a desirable activity? So I think you have to start by recognizing that the initial mention of work in the Torah appears negative. We are told in the very beginning in Bereshis and Genesis 3:19 that because of his disobedience to God, Adam is cursed, requiring him to earn his bread or livelihood by the sweat of his brow. B'zeis apecha tochal lechem is the expression in Bereshis, through by the sweat of your brow you shall eat bread. That which seems to be, it's a curse, it's a negative activity. Now there, if you look at Rashi, if you look at the classic commentator Rashi on that verse, what you will see is that he also seems to interpret it negatively. Rashi says on that verse, after, quote, after this, you will strain at work a great deal. In other words, after God has ordered this curse that you shall eat bread by the sweat of your brow, you will strain at work. It will not be easy. It will be something that will not come very easily to you. But in fact, not all the great commentators agree with that. Some do not see this as a negative characterization at all. Rather, they interpret it to demonstrate that man's sustenance comes only by the grace of God. Let me share this screen where you will see how the Medrash approaches the idea of work. Okay, so this is Bereshis Rabbah 20, and it refers to two verses of the Torah in Bereshis in Genesis. So the first verse, and this, unfortunately, Safari doesn't have this in English, so I will translate it. It says in chapter 3:17, it says, "In toil shall you eat bread." So the various commentators talk about what that means. Ravasi said the difficulties of earning a livelihood are twice as great as those of childbirth. In respect of birth, it is written. That in pain shall thou bring forth children. Then the other Rebbe Lezer, and whereas in respect of a livelihood, it is written that in great pain you shall eat of it. Oh, I see, I didn't share it. So here's the screen. I'm sorry. So here we see it. Here's the section that I'm talking about. And again, as I said, it's not translated into English, so I'm doing that. Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman said, redemption is likened to the earning of a livelihood. So the first case we see, it's childbirth. The second case, redemption is likened to the earning of a livelihood, and the reverse. Just as redemption requires the working of wonders by God, so does the earning of a livelihood require the same. And just as the latter must be earned every day, so does redemption occur every day. Rav Shmuel Bar Nachman said, it is even greater. Work is even greater than redemption. For redemption comes through an angel, whereas sustenance comes through the Holy One, blessed be He. Because we see when it comes to redemption, we have this famous phrase, Hamalach Hagola Simi Kol Ra. It's the angel who has redeemed me from all evil. But so that's an angel. But when it comes to parnasa, when it comes to a livelihood, it comes directly by God, because it says Poseach Es Yodecha. We say this in the Grace After Beals. He opens his hands and gives sustenance to all living thing. Rabbi Shua ben Levi says it's even greater than the splitting of the Red Sea, because in the Red Sea, by the splitting, it says to him who divided the Red Sea, and then it says by giving a livelihood, it says he gives sustenance to all living things. So these are verses that again indicate how in Jewish tradition, work was seen as a desirable activity, not as something that is to be avoided. But again, we see many examples where there's a comparison to other things here in the Medrash, and work is considered even better than that, or even at a higher level. Excuse me. So there are also many positive references to work in the Talmud. The rabbis generally perceived work to have intrinsic dignity, creating value for those who engage in it. I would say that the vast majority of rabbinic sources treat labor as a significant part of the process of moral development. For example, there is a famous verse that says Rabbi Yehuda declares that work brings honor to its master. Excuse me. We see a number of these. For the Ula, another Tana, another sage, early sage, one who benefits from the work of his hands outshines those who fear heaven. That's from the Durham 49b. While Rabbi Yirmiyahu proclaims it more dear than noble ancestry. We also see that there is a very important dictum that says that a father is obliged to teach his son a trade, lest he teach him robbery. Let me show you that inside, because I think it's an interesting verse. So let me get this up here. Condition and screen. Okay, so this is a condition, the tractate condition 29a, and here's what it says. So according to this interpretation, the Gemara comments, according to this interpretation, we learn in the Mishnah that which the sages taught us at Abraisa. Abraisa is an external saying, if you will. A father is obligated with regard to his son to circumcise him and to redeem him if he's a firstborn son, and to teach him Torah and to marry him to a woman and to teach him a trade. And some say a father is also obligated to teach his son to swim. By the way, this is very interesting because, you know, when I went to college, the college had a swimming requirement. I don't think any college has that anymore, but you had to pass a swim test. That was at Brooklyn College. And where did that come from? I think it came from this verse in the Talmud. And I know a number of colleges had those requirements at the time. Just as an aside, when I saw this, I thought it was very interesting. So Rabbi Yehuda says, any father who does not teach his son a trade teaches him banditry. In other words, will make him a thief. The Gemara expresses surprise at the statement. Can it enter your mind that he actually teaches him thievery? Rather, the Braisa means that it is as though he teaches him banditry. Since the son has no profession with which to support himself, he is likely to turn to theft for a livelihood. And so we see the importance that the Gemara attaches to learning a trade, to learning how to earn one's livelihood. Now, by the way, all these verses are in a part of the Gemara, what's called Agadata. There are two parts of the Talmud, just generally on a macro level. One is the halachic aspects, which teach and from which is derived the legal aspects of halacha, of Jewish law. And then there are a vast other part of the Talmud, which is Agadata, which is not meant to impart legal standards, but to impart values. And there are many stories. Some are quite fanciful and others are not. And there are statements which express principles. This part would be in the Agadata section of the Gemara, I think it's fair to say. But they also express the value statements of our sages. So the Talmud, which is the source of, other than the Torah, of course, which is the source of the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, they express value statements which may not have specific legal application. But these quotes that I'm sharing with you, these clearly are value statements of the Tanayim, the early sages, who express the importance, or and the Amorayim, the later sages. This is probably actually Amorayim, who express the various important principles. So we see that teaching a trade, economic activity, is a highly valued action. It's not something to be avoided. Okay, we also know that numerous duties, religious duties, are relaxed or modified to allow those who are working to continue their productivity for it with minimal disturbance. There's a Gemara that talks about there's a Gemara that discusses the obligation if neseva tukum, that you have to rise before an elder. It's actually a mitzvah, one of the 613 mitzvahs according to most, to actually rise before an elder. So the Gemara discusses the question of, well, what happens if you're working, and if you rise before the elder, you're going to have to stop working, although it's only for a second. The Gemara concludes that one should not do so, that working, if you're working for an employer, you should not rise for a sage, because for that moment you will not be working, and thus you'll be depriving your employer of the benefit of his bargain. So we see that this was highly valued. As part of a general discussion in the Gemara regarding those things that have no limit, the verse in Deuteronomy in the Devarim, which says choose life, Bachar to Bachayim, is interpreted by the rabbis to mean, what does it mean to choose life? That the rabbis interpret that to mean, and this is in the Jerusalem Talmud in Peah, to choose a trade or vocation. So you should learn how to make a living. That's a way of choosing life. There's also a very interesting comment by Maimonides, by the Rambam, about study of Torah. And he says that study of Torah that is not combined with work is actually a sin. Let me share that with you. So this is from the Mishnah Torah in the section on the laws of Torah study. And you can see what he says. Anyone who comes to the conclusion that he should involve himself in Torah study without doing work and derive his livelihood from charity desecrates God's name, dishonors the Torah, extinguishes the light of faith, brings evil upon himself, and forfeits the life of the world to come. For it is forbidden to derive the benefit from the words of Torah in this world. So you can see that. Also, they commanded and declared, love work and despise rabbinic positions. Now, again, you have to take this with a little bit of a grain of salt, because I don't want anyone to come away and say that I said that all rabbis should not be paid. That's not the point. And there are many halakhic authorizations for that. But you could certainly see the Rambam's approach, bias, whatever you want to call it. All Torah that is not accompanied by work will eventually be negated and lead to sin. This is also in Pirkei Avos, Ethics of the Fathers. Ultimately, such a person will steal from others. So again, we see that the Rambam believed strongly in the idea of work. By the way, the Rambam is heavily criticized for this position. Almost everything the Rambam said, there are different opinions. So if you were to look at the Kesef Mishnah, which is a commentary on the Rambam, Also in Shimon ben Tzemach Doran, the Tashbetz, who is another person who frequently comments on the Rambam, they vigorously disagree with the Rambam. But nevertheless, the Rambam is very important to be sure, and I'm minimizing when I say a very important opinion. You can see what his opinion on work is. He sees it as a highly desirable activity. Now, the Talmud also says, and this is in Brachos 8a, that one who derives benefit from the work of his hands is greater. This is an interesting statement. One who derives benefits from the work of his hands is greater than one who has the fear of God. Now, that seems to be a quite extreme statement, because we know how important the fear of God is in Jewish tradition. So in explaining this rather startling interpretation, given the high value of which, of course, God is held in Jewish tradition, it's explained that it is derived from the verse in Psalms. If you eat from the work of your hands, it is beneficial to you and it is good for you. There, the double benefit said, Ashreinu v'tovlach, it is beneficial to you and it's good for you, thus demonstrating that when it talks about the work of your hands, it says the double language, but when it talks about the belief in God, it only talks about, there's only a single language. And I'll show that to you in a moment, which I think will make it clear. Let me get that up on the screen. Okay, so here is the quote that I'm talking about. It's right here. And Rav Chiya bar Ami said in the name of Ula, one who benefits from his hard labor is greater than a God-fearing person. As with regard to God-fearing person, it is written, happy is the man who fears the Lord. While with regard to one who benefits from his hard work, it's written, by the labor of your hands you will live. You are happy and it is good for you. So you have the double language. Oh, I didn't share it. I'm sorry. Forget to hit the second button. I apologize. So here we go. Here's what I'm talking about. Rav Chiya bar Ami said in the name of Ula, one who benefits from his hard labor is greater than a God-fearing person, because it says, as regard to a God-fearing person, happy is the man who fears the Lord, while with regard to one who benefits from his hard work, it is written, by the labor of your hands you will live. You are happy and it is good for you. You have the double language, happy and good for you. So the Gemara explains that this means you are happy in this world and it is good for you in the world to come. And regarding a God-fearing person, it says it is good for you, but it's not. It doesn't say the second language. So the derivation is that labor, benefits from work, is actually greater than the fearing of God. Obviously, this is a position which I don't think is meant to be taken literally, but the fact is that we see the importance that the sages in the Talmud attached to work. And I'm not going to go through, there are many, many of these. I list a whole bunch of them in my book, but I will, I'll put up one more, which I think, or maybe two more that helps explain, that helps emphasize the value of work. So there's another statement. Let me pull that up. So this is from Gemara Psachim, the tractate Psachim, and I'm referring to this here. This talks about the part in Genesis, the part in Bereishis, where God is interacting with Adam. And it says, Rabbi Shulchan Levi said, when the Holy One, blessed be He, said to Adam, thorns and thistles shall it bring to you, his eyes streamed with tears. Adam said before him, Master of the universe, will my donkey and I eat from one trough? After God said to him, in the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, the same verse, Zeis apecha tocha lechem, his mind was settled, assured that if he toils, he will be able to eat bread, unlike the donkey. So again, unlike the animal who didn't have the ability to work, this was considered a positive activity, work. And also we find another one, where we also see this in the Medrash. Let me share this. So this is again from the Medrash, the commentary on the Torah by the earlier rabbis, and where it talks about, and I'll focus on this part here, Rabbi Yirmiyah. So this talks about the verse, as anyivis yegea pai, the labor of my hands. So Rabbi Yirmiyah said, labor is more precious than ancestral merit, than chus avos. For ancestral merit saved wealth, whereas labor saved life, work saved life. How do we see that chus avos, that ancestral merit saved wealth? It says, except the God of my father, you surely would have sent me away. So this refers to the part of the Torah where Jacob has a confrontation with Lavan. And he says to Lavan, if not for the God of my father, you would have sent me away and you would not have paid me. But when he first to labor, I would not have survived. In other words, if not for the merit of God, you would have killed me. I would not have survived. But when he talks about that that Lavan cheated him out of money, he says, as anivis yegat kapai ra elokim, that God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and gave judgment. So we see that the use of the reference to labor seems to have a higher priority in that he talks, and Yaakov refers to the fact that God has seen my affliction and has saved me. So again, another value statement. Excuse me, we're talking about the value of work. We also see in Brachos, in chapter Brachos, that work is compared to Torah study, one of the ultimate values of Judaism. The Gemara says there, the Talmud says there is no difference between working, between a man working honestly in a field and a sage meditating on divine law. That's Brachos 17:17a. Now, there are also, for sure, to be certain, there are also negative statements relating to work in the Jewish tradition. For example, there is a dictum that I suspect many of you are familiar with. This comes from Ethics of the Father, Ethics of the Fathers, where there is a statement that says, what's the best approach to life? It says to eat bread with salt and lie on the floor, which suggests that you should engage in minimal economic activity. Rather, you should study Torah. There are these statements, I would say, are, however, distinctly in the minority and clearly outweighed by the numerous overwhelmingly positive ones to the contrary. Interestingly enough, there are two researchers did a study. They went through the entire Torah and they did a statistical study. Excuse me. They went through the Jerusalem Talmuds and the Babylonian Talmuds. And of course, in the mode of scholars, they did a statistical study and looked at the value-oriented statements in the Torah, how many are negative and how many are positive. The citation to this is Bila Mannheim and Avraham Sella. The article is called Work Values in the Oral Torah, a Journal of Psychology and Judaism, Volume 15, Number 4, pages 241 to 60. If you want a citation, email me and I will be happy to send it to you. So they did a statistical study. So they subjected they went through the entire Talmud, both Talmuds, the Jerusalem and the Babylonian, and they found that 84% of value-oriented statements were positive towards work. So while there were 16% that were negative, the overwhelming statements are positive. In fact, even that statement that I read you from Ethics in the Fathers about eating bread with salt and lying on the floor was interpreted by the Talmud to mean that one should not spend an excessive amount of time in economic activity to the detriment of Torah study. In fact, I would say that while there are isolated negative comments on wealth, they tend to be focused on actions that detract from other positive endeavors like study of Torah. And I talk about this a bit in my book. But in any event, they're clearly the overwhelming percentage of statements, the overwhelming sentiment, if you will, in the Talmuds are towards a very positive value of work. Now, also interestingly, while Jewish tradition views work positively, it doesn't, I believe, does not favor workers over employers. There seems to be a balance. There is a bilateral concern for both employers and employees. So on the one hand, the traditional interpreters see the need for employees to be loyal, to avoid causing any damage to employers, and to treat fairly employees and co-workers. They also believe that it was necessary that workers be treated fairly and that they retain certain rights. Let me put up a quote from the Rambam, from Maimonides, which I think is relevant to this idea. So here's the Rambam. This is in the Mishneh Torah, the Yad HaChazaka, the great code of the Rambam. He has a section on hiring, and this is 13. So here's what he says. Just as the employer is warned not to steal the wages of the poor person or to withhold it from him, the poor person is forewarned not to steal from the work due to his employer. I neglect his work slightly here and there, spending the entire day in the sea. Indeed, he is obligated to be precise with regard to his time. That the importance of such preciseness is indicated by our sages' ruling that workers should not recite the fourth blessing of grace. So this is one of the issues that the Rambam deals with, and that is if you're working and you eat, you have to say grace, but you also owe a duty of loyalty to your employer. So the compromise, if you will, is you say the first three verses, but not the fourth verse. Similarly, a worker is obligated to work with all his strengths, and he quotes a couple of verses there. So we see that there's a mutual obligation between employees and employers. And examples of the high standard that employers must meet is that pursuant to biblical command, an employer must pay wages to his employees promptly. We see this in the verse in Devarim and Deuteronomy 24:15. Give him his wages on the same day. So do not let the sun go down, for he is needy and urgently depends on it. Again, workers must be paid promptly. In fact, we know that even if paying employees wages will not leave the employer sufficient funds to buy two loaves of bread for Shabbos or to buy tefillin, which is a very high standard of obligation, nevertheless, we see, this is the Bir Halacha to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Code of Jewish Law, or Chaim 242, that even if an employer would not have enough money to buy two loaves of bread for Shabbos or to, excuse me, to buy tefillin, he still must pay his employees first. We see in those situations where an employer provides food for his workers, we are told the tractate Bava Metzia in 83a, the employer must ensure that the food is supplied to the workers before the employer consumes his own meal. Now, while labor was perceived by the rabbis positively, economic activity and the accumulation of wealth. So now we go for a moment to the next step. What about not just work, but accumulating wealth? How is that seen in the Jewish tradition? I believe it is seen very positively. And here's an example. Recognizing that economic wants are satisfied only through human endeavor rather than solely through direct divine intervention, Judaism has valued the act of enabling that endeavor through economic activity. We see in Ethics of the Fathers, chapter 321, that Ein Kemach Ein Torah, where there is no bread, there is no Torah, indicating that I believe that there's a recognized need for economic activity in order to gather, make, and provide sustenance to the general population. There's a book by Meir Tamari, who was the former governor of the Bank of Israel. He passed away. I was fortunate enough to have him at my table one Shabbos when he was visiting Los Angeles. And we had a really interesting discussion about these subjects. In fact, it got pretty heated. where we disagreed on whether good ethics is good business, but that's a whole other story. But in any event, he writes in this book with all your possessions, quote, of the 613 divine commandments mentioned in the Torah, over 100 are related to the economic sphere. This compares with a mere 24 laws, which form the basis of the dietary laws that are such a well-known component of Judaism, which I think is actually a fascinating insight. If you look at the 613 commandments in the that is sort of the standard, it's actually, it's not clear whether there, in fact, are exactly 613. There probably are many more, but that's sort of the standard is seen as 613, Taryag Mitzvos. Over 100 are related to dealing with the economic sphere, while 24, only 24, if you will, are relate to kashrus, to keeping kosher, and that aspect of Judaism. So I think there's a statement there as to what the importance of the economic activity is. So ultimately, of course, Judaism recognizes that everything, including wealth, comes from the grace of God rather than solely through the efforts of man. It's this is also well, this is not from Tamari. Quote, the divine origin of wealth. This comes from this is from Tamari. The divine origin of wealth is the central principle of Jewish economic philosophy. All wealth belongs to God, who has given it temporarily to the man on the basis of stewardship for his physical well-being. So, and the concept that all belongs to God can be discerned from the biblical command for Shemitah, to let the land lie fallow in the seventh year. Of course, a field represents an asset which yields economic return. Yet God tells us that for an entire year, man must not use that asset to create wealth. The message is very clear. While man must work, he must understand that the ultimate source of wealth is from God. The Klei Yocher, a commentator on Exodus 21:1, says as follows: the goal of the Shemitah law is to instruct us not to consider the human being the complete master over the product of his field. One is obligated to have faith in God that he will provide sufficient produce in the sixth year for the seventh year. In the sixth year for the seventh year, as well as the eighth year, until new produce is harvested. Now, we also, to balance that out, we also have the concept that one does not rely on a miracle, that you simply can't let your field lie fallow and rely on a miracle. You have to work. There's a very interesting statement by a Hasidic master, Shmuel of Sukachev, who saw sanctity in engaging in trade and commerce, and rather than relying on divine providence. Let me share that quote with you, and I know we're running out of time, so I'm going to have to wrap it up, but let me share this with you, and then I'll get to some final words. So am I sharing the right screen? Can you see this quote?
Starts with Balak.
Yes.
Okay.
So there we go. Thank you. What objection could Balak have to the entry of Israel into the land of Israel? After all, they were no threat to his kingdom, nor did their entry into the land harm him in any way. However, Balak's philosophy was threatened. It was normal religion as long as the Jews lived a miraculous existence, removed from the mundane economic acts of life, their bread given to them from heaven. This all changed. Their entry from the desert into the land of Israel would change all that. In that land, their economic existence and their material wants would be satisfied through their mundane acts of plowing and sowing, of trade and commerce, of home building and industry. Their Torah laws would sanctify these acts as well. And it is this type of sanctity that the pagan world of Balak could not accept. It's a very interesting comment that there's, in fact, there is divine providence and divine evidence through the sort of the mundane laws of how work and economic activity progresses. So any event, there's a lot more to say, but we are running out of time. And I want to conclude by just, I wrote this book on the code of conduct for business. And I just want to read you a section from my conclusion, which I just think is food for thought and is worth recognizing as a good question that I have. And that is, after you've seen all these tremendous values on ethics and the statements in the Torah on ethics, so how do you explain this? And with this, I will end. So here's what I write. Despite numerous exhortations by Jewish leaders, some of whom have been mentioned in this book, that the ethical aspects of Judaism are as important as the ritual, clear empirical evidence appears to suggest otherwise. Why is this so? Why do otherwise observant Jews who are meticulous in the performance of ritual mitzvahs sometimes neglect the ethical commandments? If the basis for Jewish observance is following the will of God, as expressed in halacha, certainly the commandments that dictate honesty and truthfulness in business relations also express the same will of God. Indeed, how can it be that sometimes the very people who advocate careful observance of the ritual standards, even rabbis themselves, are the very same ones who seem to breach the ethical requirements, seemingly without even a second thought? Moreover, what are the implications of this apparent disparity between observance of the ritual and ethical commandments? What is the non-observant Jew or non-Jew to make of the spectacle of apparently observant Jews with all of the outward accoutrements of strict religious commitment being convicted of crimes demonstrating dishonesty, theft, cheating, and related moral turpitude? Is there any reasonable conclusion possible other than that ethical values and proper conduct in business and social relationship are not as important as meticulous ritual observance, that fervent prayer and study can coexist alongside deception and egregious violation of law? I say that because, and not because clearly this is a Jewish problem, this is, you see this in all phases of society, but I do believe very strongly that the ethical commandments in conduct of business and other activities is as much a part of Judaism as the ritual law, and is, and as I explained quite often through my book, it's clearly based in halacha, it's based in ethical standards, and yet we don't always see that. Now, I think that unfortunately that can create a chilul Hashem, it's a desecration of God's name. Contrast that, and this just, you know, again, it happened today, maybe you've seen it, I don't know if you've seen the story on this Hasidic Jew who on a JetBlue flight actually helped rescue a person by administering first aid and care. And what a Kiddush Hashem that makes, what a sanctification of God's name that makes when we can see that living by the commandments and following the ethical standards create the most beautiful standards. So mm-hmm. I just leave that as a question because it's a matter of interest to me how that works and how we emphasize one and sometimes not emphasize the other. So I guess we conclude with that. There's a lot more to say, but there's just not time to say it. So I thank you all. Let me look at the questions. Well, thank you. Please consider continuing the course. Well, thank you for that. I will. Oh yeah, you want me to put the email in the chat? I guess if you came on after I wrote it, you don't see it. So let me write it once more. So there is my email address. And if you are interested in any of the sources or to pursue the topic further, let me know, and I'll be happy to share with you the sources. So thank you very much. It's been a very interesting first course for Torah devotion has been very interesting, and I thank you for attending and listening, and I wish you all
luck. Okay.
Be well, everyone. Have a wonderful day. Thank you.